Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So many people still tar podcasts with that brush. They still think it's just people talking in their bedrooms really amateurishly, and that's doing podcasts a huge disservice.
More from Helen Zaltzman later as we discuss how Spotify's move into podcast distribution could give iTunes a reason to rethink its approach to on-demand audio. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson. We start with this week's picks from the UK tech news, and joining me, my venerable co-host, Ian Morris.
I salute you.
The rules governing premium phone lines will undergo huge changes from the start of July. This is coming to us from the BBC. There are 175 million phone numbers in the UK that begin with 08, 09 or 118. These are the ones that are going to be affected. And the effect is to make the call cost much clearer. Because at the moment, as I continue to read from the BBC article, unless you're calling from a BT landline, it's not possible to work out how much these phone calls can cost. And the premium numbers are often used by customer service and information lines, as we've seen. So these numbers are going to be changed. Now, the consumer groups say that most callers are basically being confused by the amount of these costs because they vary so wildly. Would you say that's the case for yourself, Ian?
Well, I never ring them, so no. But yes, I mean, I wouldn't have the first idea how much a call to one of them would cost. So if I was to call one, I would be surprised when the bill came in.
I see. Now, I do wonder if how much of a difference this is going to make. Let me explain to you how they're changing it. They want to make this simple, and they want to make it transparent. So, from the 1st of July, the cost of an 0809 or 118 number will be split into an access fee made by a telecoms provider and a second service fee made by the organisation being called. So, as you can tell, very simple so far. The telecoms firms will have to... I'm being sarcastic, by the way. That came out a bit too deadpan.
Yeah, it did a bit, didn't it?
All telecoms firms are going to have to provide the cost of their individual access charge on bills and customer contracts. So that means that when you are calling one of these non-geographic numbers, you'll be told things like calls will cost X pence per minute plus your phone company's access charge. Now, here's the thing. I don't know how much different that is from present. I mean, if you think about what it's like when you call into one of these voting systems, it says calls cost... you know, your usual text rate plus whatever it is. I think it was about 16p, I noticed, on Eurovision. And they do say afterwards, and I think this is probably the key bit for this directive, that calls from non-BT phone lines may vary. So I think, and this is where it gets a bit hypothetical for me at this point, and correct me if you think I've got this wrong, Ian, that what this is doing is it's not changing the sort of the amount things are being charged or the fact that it's split into, say, a service fee or an upfront fee or and then such and such per minute, perhaps. It's actually just unifying it from not just BT Mobile, but other non-BT lines, such as Virgin or on mobiles.
Yeah, so you've nailed it, that from what my understanding of it is. But I've already solved this problem in my head while you were talking. So what happens is when you ring up, because you get this with free phone numbers, don't you? When you call them when your phone provider doesn't support free phone, it goes, you may be charged for this service. So you get a pre-run. So what they do is they just say, you know, when you call a number, there'll have to be a database of what they charge. And then it just says, this call will cost you, you know, X amount. And there you go. Problem solved.
So a couple of other things that came out of this from July, this is still, that calls to 0800 and 0808 and 116 numbers. Now, I've not seen a 116 before, but certainly basically what you consider free phone are going to be free on mobiles too, or should at least, according to this. There may be some loopholes that a network jumps through, but the idea is that they're going to be free as well. They are currently free on 3, I believe, because 3 used free phone to 0800 as a marketing boost over recent months. But this is now hopefully going to extend to other mobile networks. So free phone, again, goes to mean free phone, which if you think back here and back in the days of early contracts, they were free back then too.
Yes, but I think that that's because the things were fundamentally structured different then. Mm. I mean, we sort of got... It used to be done on an amount.
Differently,
adverb,
but actually, Ian.
Sorry, I'm terribly sorry, Nate. But of course, actually, it probably depended on your contract, because I don't think I've ever had three 0800 numbers until I joined three. Mm. And that, I mean, and that's a 30-year-long well, not 30 years, obviously. That's a 20-year-long disgrace, isn't it, effectively? Because how is it that we're still paying for 0800 numbers on mobiles anyway? That should have been ended years ago.
Hmm.
I mean, well, there's no excuse for it.
That's good. Mm-hmm. That's going to happen from July. Very excited. There's also going to be a cap to 0900 numbers, because at the moment they can cost several quid a minute. That's Ofcom's going to cap those. So that's good news. Let's talk about money. The UK is now primarily a cashless society. What does that mean? Well, it means that 52% of payments were completed without physical currency. So that means debit cards, which could mean contactless, as well as things like payments on the internet, I guess, and phone payments. I think this is interesting. I mean, this is based on
one... Do you know what it also includes?
Go on.
Checks.
What's a check?
Exactly. So cashless payments can also include checks, because I also wrote this story after seeing it from Matt and had a look into the source, and yes, I think they factor in checks as part of the cashless payment system, which is funny,
I suppose,
isn't it?
Well, it's funny in that it's still a method of currency that is accepted, but at the same time it is accepted and it is technically non-cash payment.
True.
So. I suppose a banker's draft also counts. I used to remember wondering how you got one of those to send off for all sorts of things. Pornography,
well,
why not?
You go into a bank and you pay an extortionate amount of money to get one. A banker's draft, anyway.
Yes, but there's a couple of things that I mean that's interesting. 52%. This is according to the Payments Council, an organisation I did not know until Matt
existed,
wrote about it.
Yeah.
Exactly. But this is according to them for now. However, there's a couple of other things I wanted to mention in this. Number one, the contactless payment limit is going to be increased, made bigger, whatever. It's going from £20, which is the current limit, to £30. So this is what you pay if somebody says, can I use your contactless? And they inexplicably all seem to ask permission. I don't know how many people ever say no. I asked a girl in a restaurant the other day, has anyone ever said no? No, thank you. Please don't use contactless. And she said, I don't know. Today's my first day and you're my first customer. I was like, what are the chances? But I'm going to find out if anybody ever does say no.
Some people are fundamentally opposed to the idea of contactless for security reasons, and a lot of people do ask for it to be either disabled or to have cards that don't support it.
I agree. It is definitely much safer to put your card into a machine and visibly type four simple digits that give access to anybody to your entire bank account than tapping it against the machine. I agree.
Are you not a fan?
I'm a massive fan of contactless payments, but the fact is that there is a limit to how much you can use via contactless,
yes,
per day, which is arguably the reason people ask, because they may not want to. You may not want to have your limit increased if you're going somewhere and want to use contactless. But does anybody listening know how much the maximum limit is on a daily basis for contactless payments on a UK debit card?
No, but should I Google it?
Don't bother Googling it. Let's see if anybody listening actually knows and can write in and tell us. But the other thing that made me think the other day, I was getting very moist outside under the outdoor shower that is the rainfall of British April, or May, I suppose. And I was standing at an ATM getting money out, and it's a really slow dated ATM. I resented needing cash out of this wall, this hole in the wall. But it made me think, why do we not have contactless ATMs? Somebody on Twitter immediately said, well, that sounds like a great idea, giving everyone access to cash. But as long as it abides by the same daily limit, what difference does it make? Because I can't think of one, genuinely. What difference does it make between tapping your phone against an ATM and getting cash out, or a robber, this is the hypothetical person using this, taking your card and buying, you know, 80 quid's worth of millionaire shortbread from Costa's around the capital? Like, the effect to you is money leaving your bank account without your permission. What does it matter if they take out cash or caramel squares?
Well, I suspect, because the difference would be that if a retailer allows someone to fraudulently use your card, then they're probably responsible. or the bank may be responsible. But if you take cash out, you probably find that no one's responsible unless your card was stolen and you had reported it.
I guess so.
There might be a liability issue there. In the same way that there's a difference between how credit cards are managed and how debit cards are managed.
I think that's a fair argument. I could certainly believe that.
But I don't know. So we need someone who actually works at a bank to explain to us.
Well, let us know. podcast@natelankson.com. If you would A, like the idea of a cashless ATM, let's say it's opt-in just for the sake of argument, or if you can think of a very good reason or certainly give evidence to support Ian's very compelling argument about why this shouldn't be allowed, let us know too. podcast@natelankson.com. We move on to talking about esports, but don't switch off, couch potatoes, because this is about betting. That's right, free money at your fingertips. UK gamers, according to The Next Web, Chris Brandrick writing this, UK gamers can gamble real cash on the outcome of some of their favourite online video games thanks to a dedicated new betting site that's going to launch this month. In fact, it may have just launched. It's called Unikrn Arena. Make of that what you will. Unikrn, both misspelt and grammatically flawed, but compellingly cute. Which is going to allow users to bet on the outcome of various esports matches. Now, this is stuff like Counter-Strike, League of Legends, Dota 2. I don't know if those particular ones are actually supported here, but basically, this is the sort of the next generation of sports, if you like. There are huge, huge opportunities for people to make money off esports because for a viewer, it's the same as any other sport. Competitive tournament, you're watching it on TV or on a screen or something. You can bet on sports matches. Why not be able to bet on games as well? Probably a bunch of reasons, but I can't be bothered talking about those because I like the idea so much. Ian, thoughts, my friend?
Wow.
Do you think this is good? Do you think... Here comes a loaded question, so pull up your answer shield. Do you think that the fact that games can have things like bugs and can have things like different versions that can immediately, let's hypothesize, change a player's skill at a game and have an effect that makes it less about pure skill, as is the case in say snooker or football, that betting on them is a bit more controversial than it would be with regular sports?
It's certainly more easy to cheat on a computer game, isn't it? I would say. I mean, perhaps not evil in most cases, and I suppose at tournament level that would be quite unlikely. But I don't have any real strong feelings for it. I mean, don't forget that gaming and watching gaming globally is just phenomenal now. It's so enormous, and it's actually difficult to appreciate how big it's got unless you have a look around and see the sort of tournaments and the audiences that they attract. It's absolutely phenomenal. So there's a natural sort of thing to having betting on it. I mean, people will bet on anything, won't they? And bookies, as a rule, will let them. There was a man, wasn't there, who walked into a bookie and put a bet on the Conservatives getting a majority, and it was a £30,000 bet that netted him something like £115,000 back or something. But obviously no one believed the Tories would get a clear majority in the first place. And secondly, that's quite a specific bet, isn't it? So yeah, there you go.
It is. But to go back to your original point about numbers, you're right. And there are, according to Chris's article on The Next Web here, 70 million global viewers of esports viewership. Now this is... this is all screens, but that's a figure that's set to expand when ESPN starts to broadcast esports. Now, there are in the world dedicated esports gaming channels. I believe there might be one in Sweden. South Korea is enormous for esports. We used to have one in Sky, actually, until about 2009 called X League, but that ran for a couple of years, I think, but eventually got... shut
we
down.
Don't
I mean,
it need actually a TV feels channel like... for this, do we? Can't we just watch it on Twitch or something?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that's part of the reason why this was probably, it was basically a bit premature. But this is something you're going to see a lot of. People love watching games. It's a fact. It's sadly, when you look at something like Gogglebox, people also like doing watching people watch TV. Like, where does this end? There's a great South Park in the most recent season that parodied PewDiePie, the incredibly popular YouTube game streamer, that basically fingered people watching people, and then Cartman set up a channel to comment on people watching people play video games. It's how deep does this, how many turtles down does this go?
I mean, I do understand the urge. I mean, I'm sort of generally quite excited about the idea of watching gaming tournaments. I mean, they can be, I mean, okay, they're not sporting skill, but they can be their own kind of skill. And some games are incredibly interesting to watch anyway. It doesn't surprise me. I have no ill feeling towards betting on such things, and I kind of hope there's more of it.
A massive potential money pit. But who is going to swan dive into that and swim around in that financial pool of success? Let us know if you're pulling up your money trunks now, people. podcast@natelangson.com. What do you think? Not everyone in the world is as beautiful as you, dear listener, and not everyone knows how to download a podcast. That's why I'm encouraging you to bring someone you know into the podcasting world by telling them about this show and which app you use to listen to it. You'll be helping not only me in text message, but all podcasters who often need word of mouth more than money to help promote their work. Thanks for listening, and hopefully, thanks for the review and the help spreading the word. Or if you want to be on the show, send your comments about this episode or any other tech topic, podcast@natelangson.com. Well, that's going to do it for our news this week. We've got a bumper set of your feedback coming in. The mailbox has been bulging like a sack of excitable contents this week. podcast@natelangson.com. We're going to get to those in a few minutes. But first, we're going to talk about Spotify and podcasting. This month, Spotify did something very interesting if you're a podcaster or if you are interested in podcasting. It has started to support podcasting networks, which means you're going to start to be able to listen to some of the biggest podcasts in the world through Spotify. It's very exciting. It's not something that the independent podcasters of the world, such as Ian and I, are privy to begin with. We're talking about very large tie-ups with companies like Radiotopia and the Twit Network and things like that. MTV is on there too. But it does raise some questions about what Spotify's intentions are, and who better to ask than the host or co-host of Answer Me This and also The Illusionist, which is on the Radiotopia network, Helen Zaltzman. So I asked Helen to begin with, what exactly does the Spotify integration of podcasting mean for the world of podcasting? And specifically to begin with, what does it mean for podcasters?
Well, firstly, it means 60 million potential new listeners, because Spotify has a huge user base. And the problem that podcasting has faced thus far is it just hasn't been that easy to get them. So you don't get that many casual listeners because you have to go through so many steps to get a podcasting app or go to a show's website. Whereas a lot of people already have Spotify, so it's very easy to access. And it's good for me because my shows are going to be on it. There's a curated selection of shows, at least to begin with. So I guess if people are thinking, oh, I don't know where to start with podcasts, having a limited selection maybe will get them in there, and then they start following their own taste to other shows.
I see.
My concerns are with how the advertising is going to work, because if I was a Spotify subscriber who was paying not to have adverts, how would I feel about podcasts having host-read adverts in them? Because a lot of advertising content is very much incorporated into the material of the show. That's how I do it, so that it's not too off-putting for the listener to hear the advert. So I try to make them entertaining and interesting.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
But if I paid for no ads, don't know if I would want that.
I suppose my inherent cynicism would probably land around the area of that there is a huge amount of corporate promotion that goes on inside music videos and indeed in a lot of pop songs themselves. And so they're probably, on a subliminal level, already being advertised to quite regularly. But that is just, of course, my cynical view of the mainstream pop music industry.
Well, that's not cynical, that's just factual. they're not spontaneously showing off the features of that mobile phone during their video for nothing.
No, true.
But that is sort of subliminal. It's quite brazen subliminal advertising, but still subliminal, whereas this would be surliminal, people reading about Squarespace and so on. The other thing is, though, if you take the ads out of the podcast and put up a special version on Spotify, you're not going to make a lot of money from having your podcast on Spotify. It's really to get the listeners than it is to generate income. But if you don't have the ads in, then you will generate less income. So there's that kind of quandary. And if you've got people paying to use Spotify, they're not going to think, oh, I should pay to listen to the podcast, which at the moment some people do. They like to reward the people that have given them free to access entertainment. But I think if you were already paying for the service, then you wouldn't have that urge. Your urge would have been quenched. So that's the other thing. If you've got a file as long as a podcast, because I don't know what the average length is, but probably over half an hour for a podcast episode. If you've got an ad every three files, like you do with music or thereabouts, then you might go for an hour and a half without listening to an ad. And again, I wonder what that does with the apportionment of revenue.
I suppose it's the access argument there, isn't it? I mean, Spotify isn't having to pay individual podcasters. I mean, I don't know how much money is changing hands involved in this, and feel free to enlighten me if you have knowledge about that. But I mean, a lot of podcasters, certainly independent podcasters, and myself included, money isn't necessarily the driving reason to create a show. And so there may not be a huge need for them to push for adverts to appear more regularly than just between each podcast episode.
Well, lucky you that you don't need the podcast to make money. For a lot of people, it's the only way they can justify the time. And I think in America as well, they're just a few years ahead than we are in Britain about both paying for podcasts and being paid to podcast. And if you're setting about it seriously, it can take a lot of time to make a show. If it's taking you 3 days to make a show out of a week, that is too much time really to give for free. I know, because I gave that time for free for several years and I was really poor and found it very hard to pay my rent. So that's why one needs to be paid to make podcasts if you have if you're trying to make a good show.
Definitely. I completely agree. I suppose that actually quite nicely leads me into what I wanted to talk about next, which is the in the world of podcasts, we are not all born equal in this sense, because at the very, very top of what is still technically a podcast, you have the likes of BBC, of the kind of major radio and TV broadcasters, who treat podcasts in a way, for better or for worse, depending on your viewpoint, as an alternative way to provide either catch-up content for their subscribers or people who pay the license fee, or as exposure for the shows in the first place. And then in below that, and in no less in terms of importance, but in terms of thinking purely as business, there are the podcasts that are very big, very successful, make money, and I'm thinking obviously of your shows in this context, who
I'm very rich.
Well, what I mean is that, you know, my show is very much a labor of love. It's a passion. It doesn't take me a huge amount of time to do, and I largely just do it because it gives me an opportunity to call up Helen Zaltzman and say, Helen, do you want to talk about podcasting for 10 minutes on a show?
You can call any time, Nick.
but there's what I mean is there's a very wide range of podcasters, and these, the ones that have been announced so far, which as I say include the likes of BBC, of WNYC, of Twit, even, which is a pure podcasting network, but very much run as a more like a TV or radio network online, they're big boys. They're big money, profitable, or at least for profit, and they are the ones that are going to dominate the listenership. They're not ones I would necessarily class as podcasts in the traditional sense, which are people like either myself or like Answer Me This, for example, that are run out of a bedroom and, you know, very successful in their own way.
Well, they've also partnered with Libsyn, which is a podcast host that I use for Answer Me This, and that's very podcast focused rather than repackaged radio. And they've also partnered with Radiotopia, which is the collective that my other show, The Illusionist, is part of. And Radiotopia, that's basically the island of misfit toys, as podcasters go. That's a lot of people that would never get those shows on radio.
Yes.
And have found this different channel to make things work.
This, to me, Spotify, looks like it could heat up the competition with iTunes, because it is a very accessible place to be. People already are there looking for audio content. And I wonder how you feel that might affect the iTunes dominance, if you like, in the distribution space. I appreciate it's a very loaded question, but...
Yes, because iTunes have been extremely good to me over the years. They've been invaluable support, because when you're making a podcast just in your own home and no one knows who you are, them promoting it makes an immense amount of difference, particularly back when they first did that for us, which was about a year into doing Answer Me This, so late 2007. And there were fewer podcasts around then, and really everybody was getting them through iTunes. Mm. So to see them on iTunes, you would it was a gigantic spike in listenership. And it's not the same now. I think the thing is, it's surprising that iTunes went for podcasts in the first place, given that they make no money out of them. And it's a bit of a faff for them to process them and everything, but they still do. So I wonder whether that's just why the store is lagging behind a little bit, because it's not an obvious moneymaker, so the priority is going to be on other things. But I think this could galvanize iTunes to buck up the service a bit. The benefit of Spotify is that it's not solely Apple. There are a lot of people who don't use iTunes or Apple products. And I don't think there's a great non-Apple alternative yet for finding podcasts. There isn't one that has kind of streaked ahead to be a proper iTunes rival. There are lots that are around, but not a big dominant one. So I think Spotify could easily be that. The other thing that Spotify is doing is building a dashboard for podcast producers. So you'll be able to see things like, because Spotify allows streaming very easily, how long people are listening to your shows and whether they skip bits. And that could be very useful data to have.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. It's particularly perhaps with the longer shows. I aim my show at a commuter, basically. And a commuter's length. And it does seem to, in some of the conversations I've had with other distributors, that sort of half hour, 20 minutes, between 20 minutes and 40 minutes seems to be about the perfect length for a podcast in terms of getting people to completion. And there's a big drop off after that sort of period. Maybe this would give a much wider range of networks the sort of analytics to almost reformat their shows. And I wonder whether that's a good thing or not.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the platform actually does offer, because something that never really took off thus far is having chapters in your podcast, which for a lot of shows, like Answer Me This, it's in sections because it's different questions. So if someone could just skip to the next question, then that'd be kind of useful for them. Not so great for us, but it'd be good for them. And so I don't, if because Spotify looks more hospitable to you scrolling along, it could offer that. I think that'd be quite handy. There are lots of things they could do. I think still podcasting is so undeveloped that there would be room for somebody to come along with just a way to listen to them that we haven't even conceived of, that seems really obvious once they've done it. And still no one has done the Netflix discovery system for podcasts. I've been on about this for years now and still no one has built me it, where it's like, if you like this, then you might like this. And it suggests shows you're not looking for, because that's part of the problem with discovery. It's hard to find shows that you weren't looking for, except via word of mouth. And I think there's a big gap for that. But again, that's a difficult thing for somebody to make money out of. So there's not much incentive to build it.
It will be interesting to see if that's something that Spotify does build. I mean, personally, I'm very excited about this. The more opportunities there are for people to discover podcasting, the better. And
yes,
and they've got the right sort of names on board here for to launch with, you know, people that are giving a really positive impression for podcasts, something more polished than perhaps they were when they first started out. I think that's...
Yeah, and so many people still tar podcasts with that brush. They still think it's just people talking in their bedrooms really amateurishly, and that's doing podcasts a huge disservice.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, and who should people tune into of your many tentacle-like output? I don't, not quite sure where I'm going with that.
I'm not sure. I think you're saying where can people see my tentacles? They can come along to my tank at 3 when the aquarium master gives me my snack.
But if people wanted to find one of your shows on Spotify, which one should they look out for?
The one that I definitely know is going to be on there is called The Allusionist. That's with an A. It's not about illusionists. And that's part of the Radiotopia network. So I think all of the Radiotopia shows will be on there. And they're all good, so treat yourself.
Thank you to Helen Zaltzman for that chat. Very interesting stuff. I hope you'll agree. Do check out her show, The Allusionist. Really is well worth listening to. One of the things that's quite nice about it is they are quite short, so they are good for just that walk from the house to the shops and back. If your house is precisely 6 minutes from the shop, because the last episode was about 12 minutes, that counts both directions. I wanted to turn our attention to a couple of emails that we've had this week in the podcast@natelankson.com email swag bag. Now, Ian, you're going to take the first one here, which came in from Mr. Jimmy.
So Jimmy says, I'm a freelance graphic designer and a long-term user and fan of Apple products. I own a 2007 iMac, a 2010 Mac Pro and an iPhone 4. As a fan of new tech, I'm always tempted by new Apple products upon their release, and when friends get out their new phones and thinner Retina laptops, a part of me always considers looking for available deals in the hope of upgrading. On the other hand, I don't agree with the way that so many of us have become accustomed to purchasing tech products, religiously buying the latest phone when there isn't a lot wrong with what you've got. I use my phone, laptop and desktop more than people would use theirs, so I'm very aware of computers slowing down and software updates becoming few and far between, etc. But rather than buy a new laptop, for example, I've upgraded the hard drive to 512GB as an SSD to keep its speed up. My girlfriend has an iPhone 3GS, which she has been using every day for 5 years, and she has no plans of upgrading soon. As a fellow graphic designer and someone who uses Apple products every day, she obviously would love the speed and features of newer products. But as someone who cares about the issues of sustainability and the design of products forefronting their lifespan of the product, I can't help but think that Apple just wants to sell more of the latest products with disregard for its loyal customers and the environment.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? And actually, the environmental one was one that we just didn't really consider at all. But that was because it was sort of outside the scope of the argument, wasn't it? But it's a good point.
It is a very good point, and definitely one that we should address. I suppose it's one Apple tries to address in its marketing. It's not something that anyone ever really reports on when Apple has its press announcements. But one of the things that it always does in its keynote is throw out a big long list of all the ways that it is green. Its products are green, environmentally friendly, recyclable, EP Gold certified. They'll list a whole bunch of stuff that it doesn't have in it. All these sorts of things. And it's almost like it's there as kind of a preemptive rebuttal to these sorts of comments from Jimmy. But I do think they're good comments. I mean, I think that an iPhone 3GS is pushing it. to be honest, I would be surprised if Jimmy's other half didn't use an iPhone 6, let's say, and immediately wants to upgrade afterwards, because the difference between those two models is definitely worth an upgrade. I think you can go from 3GS to 6 and still feel like you're hanging on to your tech for a very long time. I mean, 5 years is long, even if you were using a Nokia back in the day. And they are some of the longest lasting devices. I mean, it'll be them and cockroaches during an apocalypse, let's put it that way.
But wasn't it the 3GS that they were discontinuing support for that you were getting so irate about?
Yes, but only because it was released as far as recently as 2012. And my argument wasn't that people shouldn't want to upgrade. But just the fact that Apple shouldn't be killing support for something it manufactured as recently as 3 years ago.
No, fair enough. Support is very different to, to speed. And obviously, you need support. But actually, you're right. But some people use different, get different uses out of things, don't you? I couldn't survive on a 3GS, but I'm sure plenty of people in my family could.
Mm. Oh yeah, definitely. Let's move on to the second email we've got. This comes from Andy, who's not Andy, my brother, who's been on the show in the past. This is a different Andy. Hi, Nate and Ian. Got to mention this time, mate. Following your piece in last week's text message podcast, I thought I'd write in. I've been a resident of London for over 12 years and use various forms of taxi throughout, both before and after the rise of app-based services. Whilst I agree that black cabs are being disrupted by the likes of Uber, and you did forget to mention that black cabs have their own apps, such as Halo and Cabby, we did not mention those. And in fact, Halo was started by three cabbies back in the day. But so you're right there, Andy. He continues, I don't think there is much of a challenge as you think. The problem comes down to the knowledge, which in my opinion is considerably better than using GPS, as it's more than just being able to read a map. It's knowing where you are or someone else is and what's nearby. I've often been able to jump in the back of a black cab, tell them where I'm going, and then put my headphones in, comfortable in the knowledge that they know where they're going to go. With Uber, which I've tried several times, I had to tell them each step of the way, and at one occasion I had a driver ring me three times before arriving to find which pub to pick me up in from Camden. I agree, and weirdly, I've done exactly the same as that, and in Camden from a pub. So maybe that's the problem. It's the black hole of Camden. Overall, Andy continues, I think there's something to be said for the combination of a decent price, a good app to call from, comfort, and the knowledge of your driver. And with that in mind, I actually have been using Addison Lee for a while now, as for me, they seem to manage a good combination of all those criteria. Keep up the great work with the podcast, Andy. I do agree, Addison Lee, great for corporate customers, but the problem is they do not compete on price.
No, they are very expensive, Addison Lee.
Addison Lee are brilliant as a service, but my God, do you pay for that service compared as a single customer needing to go one place? They are not a service that I would use. There is another app that I quite like that my brother and I used to use for a bit called Wheelie, which is more of a competitor to Addison Lee and not competitively priced, but does seem to be better priced than Addison Lee for single uses. And they have very, very good cars. That's called Wheelie. I think they're still around and operating in London, and they're very, very good.
What we need really is a sort of a service where cab drivers can bid on your journey.
Takes too long though, doesn't it?
Well, not necessarily.
I don't want to sit around while cab drivers play black cab eBay in the.
Well, it could be a really short window. Like this guy wants to go from here to here. Mm. What's your bid? And they all bid down to the one that thinks it's not worth doing it. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, there was a great episode of Dragon's Den a few years ago where there was a guy who had created sort of like Uber app, but without the app. It was a phone call. You sort of called up a network of cabbies for directions rather than a ride. And if you can look it up, it's well worth it. It was hideously badly presented, and the guy got absolutely flamed, which means it's very entertaining. If you go to YouTube and search, I don't know, taxi service Dragon's Den, I'm sure you'll find that. So thank you, Andy and Jimmy, for your emails this week. We did have more than just those two emails, but in the interest of time, I've bumped the others to next week. But obviously, keep them coming in, podcast@natelangson.com on any topic from today, or just anything you'd like to hear us discuss. Ian, that has been a pleasurable experience.
No, always my pleasure.
We'll see you all in a week. Thanks for listening to Text Message, a weekly free podcast produced, edited, and funded by me, Nate Langson. Don't forget, you can help so much by bringing someone you know into the podcasting world by telling them about this show and which app you use to listen to it. From the Corner Studio in my house in Ealing, London, thanks again for listening and for any help in spreading the word. I like to heal in non-traditional ways. You never know